Trump's acquittal effectively ended the Trump era, at least for now. Today on The Dirt Show, you'll hear my assessment of the last 4 years and my predictions as to what is coming now on The Dirt Show. The Senate's acquittal of Donald Trump really marks the end of the Trump political era, at least for now. Donald Trump will continue to be a force in Republican politics, but he will not be in the news every day. The focus of attention will not be on him as it has been for the last almost 5 years now. And we're going to move on, for better or for worse. And so this is an appropriate time both to look backward and to look forward. Let's begin by a backward look. What has Trump's 5 years in the limelight, beginning in the run-up to the 2016 election when he announced his candidacy to basically this past Saturday, what is the legacy? What has it done to America and for America? I'm going to try to be as balanced as I possibly can, as nuanced as I possibly can, and look at the 5 years from a historic perspective and from a civil liberties perspective and from any other perspective that seems warranted. Let's start with what I think no one can dispute. That is, the country is more divided after these 5 years than it was before the 5 years. Look, it was divided in the run-up to 2016. That's one of the reasons that Donald Trump got traction. He sensed, he whiffed, he foresaw, he understood what was going on in the world. I predicted Trump's victory after a trip to Europe that I had taken with my family. And I saw in the summer of 2016 a deeply divided world. I saw Brexit. I predicted Brexit correctly. I saw what was going on in Eastern Europe with renewed fascism coming to some countries, or at least authoritarianism coming to some of the Eastern European countries. I saw deep division in Great Britain and France and Italy, and I saw it in the United States, and so did Donald Trump. And he took advantage of it. And when he ran for president as a candidate for the Republican nomination, it was Trump against a field of nine, then it became eight and seven and five. But it was always Trump standing out and making his very visible presence. He stole the stage. He stole the limelight. I don't mean stole in a negative way. That's what politicians try to do. But he was the limelight. He was the stage. And I predicted, along with many others, that he would get the nomination. Had he run against one strong candidate? Not so clear. But running against 9876 and Trump, there was Trump. So he took advantage of that situation, and to his credit, he prevailed and got the nomination overwhelmingly. Then he won the election, and he won the election fair and square. Although I voted against him, I voted for Hillary Clinton, I campaigned for her, I supported her, I financially contributed to her campaign, I was anxious to see her win. I immediately accepted Trump's victory, notwithstanding the fact that some factors that contributed to it were unfair, mostly James Comey's misuse of his bully pulpit to attack Hillary Clinton's use of her emails, when he said, look, they weren't illegal, but what she did was wrong and irresponsible. That's not the job of either the director of the FBI or a prosecutor. They're supposed to just announce, we're going to charge or we're not going to charge. If you're going to charge, read the indictment. If you're not going to charge, that's the end of it. That may very well have contributed to Hillary Clinton's defeat, along with many other factors. But I immediately accepted the election results. And then the next 4 years were tumultuous and divisive. And equal blame, you'll hear from me, goes to both sides. Trump engaged in lots and lots of divisive actions. Initially, his attempt to restrict immigration from predominantly Muslim countries. I predicted he would win that lawsuit, but I opposed what he was doing as a matter of policy. My prediction was correct. He did win the lawsuit after he modified the action. Presidents have enormous authority over immigration, over foreign policy, and so the decisions of the courts to sustain his what was called Muslim ban, it was not quite that. He didn't ban people from many, many Muslim countries, but particularly the largest Muslim countries in the world, Indonesia, etc. But he did ban them from countries that were predominantly, almost exclusively, Muslim. So that was a divisive. His approach to immigration in general was divisive, particularly his approach to Mexico, the wall, the separation of parents and children, something obviously that had been done previously as well, because when you arrest an adult, what do? You have to separate the child. You can't put the adult in prison with the child. It was an awkward, cumbersome policy, and one that violated core values, particularly core Republican family values. And it was extremely, extremely divisive, caused all kinds of pictures, some valid, many invalid. Some came from the Obama administration showing, quote, kids in cages. Always a bit overstated, but clearly a legitimate concern of those who care deeply about the rights of children. So we saw division there. We certainly saw division when the COVID plague struck the world. I believe myself that Donald Trump probably would have been reelected, but for COVID. I think he, and I think that's true of many politicians. We may see Cuomo have a major negative impact on his career as to how he handled COVID. The governor of California is now subject to a recall. In Israel, an election that's coming up in March is going to focus on how leaders dealt with COVID. Britain, all kinds of complaints. I think only Germany, with the retiring Angela Merkel, seemed to have survived. The leadership seemed to have come out ahead. Bibi Netanyahu may too have come out ahead ultimately, but much, much criticism. President Trump did not come out ahead. He vacillated back and forth, didn't do enough to tell the American public to wear masks and to socially distance and to close down. He was getting pressure from his base to open up. He lost votes, without a doubt, based on his handling. You know, it's interesting. I remember having a talk with President Clinton once, shortly after his presidency was over, when people on Martha's Vineyard were still talking to me and inviting me to gatherings. I was at a gathering with Bill Clinton, who had just left the presidency. And he basically said to me, not exactly in these words, that his presidency was not, didn't have a lot of crises. There was not a lot of opportunity to prove his greatness as a president. Great presidents are picked based largely on how they handle crises. Obviously, Lincoln, Roosevelt, others who handled crises extraordinarily well. If you don't have a crisis, you can't prove yourself. And Donald Trump didn't have a crisis until COVID. And certainly the result of that was a mixed assessment, a mixed evaluation. I think more critical than positive. And I do think that it was COVID that contributed more to his electoral defeat in 2020 than any other single factor. There were many other factors that contributed, but that was probably the single most important factor. And then we come to the most controversial, and in my view, the most critical and the most deserving of criticism phase of President Trump's presidency. And that is the period of time between Election Eve and the inauguration of President Biden. There, I think President Trump failed. Instead of simply protesting the outcome and bringing lawsuits, which he had the right to do, he insisted on making overblown claims of election fraud, and the election was stolen, and refusing to concede. My own view, and I said it at the time, is he should have, if not conceded, at least earlier on acknowledged that it was a fait accompli. And he should have come to the inauguration and essentially been there symbolically to hand over power and to see a peaceful transition instead of getting on a plane and going to Florida. So I am extremely critical of how he handled those 3 months. It was a major reason why I did not want to become his lawyer in his second impeachment, though I firmly believe his second impeachment was unconstitutional, as was the first. His second impeachment was unconstitutional, as you know from hearing it from me, on two grounds. Number one, the Senate had no jurisdiction to try a former president. And second, his speech was completely and totally protected by the First Amendment. But I didn't want to be his lawyer. I didn't want to be his lawyer because I did not want to be involved in any case that questioned the legitimacy of the election. And I was concerned that on the floor of the Senate, a question would be put, as it was, or arguments would have to be made involving whether the election was stolen and fraudulent. And I don't believe it was. Could it have been handled better? Absolutely. I think the Supreme Court should have reviewed the Texas case and should have reviewed the Pennsylvania case. I do think that Pennsylvania acted unconstitutionally by extending the time by which ballots could be received beyond the time authorized by the legislature. The courts have no authority under the Constitution to extend the time. The Constitution says state legislatures make those decisions, not the courts. There's an argument on the other side saying the courts are the creature of the state legislatures, but I don't think that argument prevails. I think that Trump gets the better of the Pennsylvania argument, but there weren't enough votes in dispute based on that issue to turn around Pennsylvania, so I do not think the election was stolen. As you know, I've called for the creation of a VIP, a voter integrity panel, which could look at every single claim, and I have an open mind. If a voter integrity panel established that there were computer problems or there were miscounting or there were deliberate fraud, I'm open to reassess my views. But I think the burden of proof is on those who would change the results of an election. After all, at least according to the counting that was certified by every single state, the popular vote, 7 million more for Biden than for Trump, and the Electoral College, enough votes to make a difference in the outcome. But if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'm happy to reassess. But based on what I know, I didn't want to be part of a campaign, an election campaign, or an impeachment defense that would raise questions about the legitimacy of the Biden presidency. Biden is president. I'm looking forward to supporting his policies when I agree with them and disagreeing with his policies when I think they're wrong. So that's my looking back sense. I think the First Amendment has been wounded. I think equal blame for that goes to both sides more, I think, for the critics of Trump than for Trump and his supporters. I think Trump pushed the limits of the First Amendment with his January 6th speech. I think he pushed the limits of free speech on a number of occasions with his tweets, but hey, you're entitled to push to the limits. And the overreaction by the Trump haters and the Trump enemies and the get Trump at any cost liberals was the main cause of why our First Amendment has suffered grievously over the last 4 years. The First Amendment is not as strong today as it was 4 years ago. It is certainly not as strong today as it was during the golden era of the First Amendment when I was practicing actively. I was a law clerk during the beginning of the gold era. I was a law clerk when New York Times versus Sullivan was decided. I helped draft, along with my co-clerk, the concurring opinion in that case for Justice Goldberg. I was part of the litigation team in the Pentagon Papers case, in the I Am Curious Yellow case, the Hare case, the Deep Throat case, the Assange case, the Chicago 7 case, you name it. Virtually every First Amendment case that we litigated during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s and 90s, we won. I also lost a very important First Amendment case, the Frank Snepp case. I tried to get certiorari review by the Supreme Court of the attempt by the CIA to censor a book written by Frank Snepp, who had been the station head of the CIA in Vietnam and wrote a book called Decent Interval, which was very critical of our handling of the exit from Vietnam. And the CIA effectively censored parts of the book. I tried to get it uncensored. I lost, but I won, I think, every other First Amendment case I litigated during that golden era. That era is over. It's been tarnished, and it's been tarnished by the opponents of Trump during the past 4 years. It has been tarnished by Common Cause, a liberal organization that calls for Facebook to keep Donald Trump off its platform. It has been tarnished by Nicholas Kristof, who claims to be a big supporter of the marketplace of ideas, but who wants to take Fox and Newsmax off cable platforms. I don't know the technology of it, but effectively imposing McCarthyism, red channels, blacklisting, private company censorship on free speech. So the First Amendment has suffered grievously. I think judicial independence has suffered. I think the Trump administration, and even before the Trump administration, Senator Mitch McConnell hurt judicial selection and the independence of the judiciary by his hypocritical stance toward the nomination of Supreme Court justices in the year before an election. Recall that when Merrick Garland was nominated 8 months before the election of 2016, McConnell stopped that very good nomination from getting to committee or getting to the floor of the Senate, concocting an excuse that in the last year of a presidency, there is to be no Supreme Court nominations considered. Call that the February exception. Why? I don't know. He's the president until the end. He gets the right to appoint under the Constitution. But McConnell invented a new rule and applied it to Merrick Garland, who is now the Attorney General of the United States. But then, when the shoe was on the other foot, McConnell utterly failed that test when President Trump nominated Barrett to replace Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. They rushed through the nomination. Hey, sure, it was only weeks before the election, but we forgot what we said previously, or it was different because the Senate was controlled by one party, the presidency by another party back in 2016. Now the Republicans control both. That's not a moral argument. That's a power grab. So I think judicial independence was hurt during the last 4 years. On balance, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? Domestically, from a civil liberties point of view, no. From a foreign policy point of view, yeah, I think so. I think Trump did some very good things in terms of foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East. The Abraham Accords, the movement of the embassy of Israel to Jerusalem, the recognition of the Golan Heights as within Israeli sovereignty, the attempt to prevent anti-Semitism on college campuses. All of those I participated in. I was honored to be asked by the Trump administration to play a role in consulting and advising on all of those issues. And I did with a pleasure and with a sense of pride and accomplishment. The Iran deal, I'm not sure it was best just to unilaterally get out of the deal, but it was certainly best not to stay in the deal as written. The Obama-Iran deal was a catastrophe, a disaster, a green light, an invitation to a nuclear-armed Iran, which Israel would never allow to happen. Let's see what the Biden administration does. He has said he won't go back into the deal unless there is greater degree of compliance and unless the deal is expanded to include rockets and terrorism. Open mind. We'll see. I remain able to criticize people I voted for, people I voted against. Let's wait and see what the Biden administration does on that. So that's my assessment looking backward. Now let's look forward. What I see in the future is very dangerous. I see Republicans now trying to take revenge. We already hear some senators and congressmen saying, as soon as Republicans gain control of the House, we'll impeach Vice President Harris. One member of Congress already said, we'll impeach Biden. You know, two wrongs don't make a right. That's not the answer. If any of these folks are impeached, I'm going to be there defending them as vigorously as I defended President Trump. I do not believe impeachment should be weaponized and used as a tit-for-tat revenge weapon against the party that's out of power in the House of Representatives or the Senate. I hope we don't have another impeachment in my lifetime. I don't want to see this weaponization of the Constitution continue. What else are we seeing in the future? We're seeing people who won't give up on trying to get Trump. We got to get him, no matter what. Let's criminally prosecute him. Let's find the crime. Let's invent the crime. On television this morning, you heard a congressman say, hey, we're going to sue Trump and Giuliani under the so-called Ku Klux Klan Act, an act passed in the wake of the Civil War that was designed to prevent violent efforts to intimidate members of Congress or other government officials. And they're suing Trump for that, for making a speech. Yeah, Trump threatened. Yes, he threatened people. He threatened them with being primaried. That's constitutionally permissible. You can threaten a political opponent with being primaried. You can threaten to cut off funding. You can threaten to filibuster. You can threaten to do anything. You can threaten to send people to the Capitol to peacefully and patriotically protest. That's all protected. And if the Ku Klux Klan Act were to be applied to President Trump's speech or his activities in the run-up to the January 6th disaster, that would make the statute unconstitutional. But my point is different. My point is, lay off. You know, stop it. It's enough already. You tried to impeach the guy. You got him impeached. He was acquitted. Now there are efforts to try to find crimes, discover crimes, invent crimes, concoct crimes. No, that's not the way our legal system operates. You've heard me make this analogy before, but it is a very apt analogy. In Stalinist, the Soviet Union, Lavrenty Beria, the head of the notorious KGB, went to Stalin and said, show me the man and I'll find you the crime. That's not the American way. We should not be searching for crimes for which to prosecute former President Trump. He's out of the news. Keep him out of the news. Let's move on. Let's put Biden in the news. Let's put the Biden administration in the news. Let's focus on COVID. Let's focus on restoring the economy. Let's focus on foreign policy. Let's focus on trying to bring about peace in the Middle East. Let's focus on stopping Iran from becoming a nuclear armed state. These are all important issues that we can focus on. Let's celebrate the end of the Trump era with his acquittal in the Senate, and let's stop these foolish investigations, lawsuits, alleged criminal trials. Let's move forward. Let's remember Lincoln again, with malice to none and charity to all. Let's move forward. The time has come to rebuild. The time has come to reunite. President Biden ran on a platform of uniting the country. I think he made a mistake by encouraging, I'm sure he was pressured to do so by his base, by encouraging the impeachment trial. That's over now. Let's try to build bridges. Let's try to rebuild friendships that were destroyed, family relations that were destroyed by the divisiveness caused by both Trump and his haters and his opponents and those who tried to get him at any cost. We're better than that. And I think we can rebuild our country. And I think we can regain friendships. And I think most important, we can try to restore civil liberties in this country. Here I make a plea to my fair weather civil liberties friends, my summer warriors, in the words of the great Thomas Paine. Those who defend civil liberties only when it serves their political interests to do so. The Larry Tribes of the world, the others who are willing to compromise civil liberties whenever it's in their partisan interest to do so. Enough already. Trump is no longer president. Let's try to rebuild the First Amendment. Let's try to restore due process. Let's remember how essential freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to peacefully assemble, how important they are, how important due process is, how important the right of counsel is. Let's end this modern McCarthyism. Let's stop trying to disbar lawyers who made arguments in favor of Trump. As some of you know, when I was on Fox Sunday morning, I made an offer. I said, any lawyer or anybody who is subject to this new McCarthyism, who is not allowed to speak on campus, who is denied a professorship, who is subject to discipline and disbarment because of their associations with Donald Trump, I will defend them. I will stand up for them. I will be their lawyer if they want me to be their lawyer. I will devote myself to protecting this country against renewed McCarthyism. Why? Because I lived through the old McCarthyism. I saw what it did to friends and neighbors and family. And I never want to see McCarthyism become Americanism. I never want to see the cancel culture become the American culture. There's a risk that's happening, and I'm going to stand up against it. If I stand alone, I'm comfortable standing alone. I have colleagues, I have friends, not many, I can count them on one hand, who are prepared to stand up for civil liberties regardless of whose civil liberties is affected. Free speech for me but not for thee is free speech for nobody. And so I worry about the future. I worry about what happened over the last 4 years. I worry whether it will continue for the next 4 years. And I'm here to try to stop that. And you'll hear on The Durst Show how we can fight back against cancel culture, against the new McCarthyism, how we can fight for equal rights for all, for free speech for all, for due process for all. That's what you're going to hear on The Durst Show. Now let's hear from you. Let's turn now to our first caller for today.
Hi, Hunter from Orlando, Florida. I was wondering what you think of the doctoring of the evidence in the trial, and if that would be, would that get a normal lawyer disbarred? If a normal lawyer in regular low-level court brought in their evidence and it turned out to be edited, and then when they get called out for it, they don't even deny that it was edited or doctored, would this get a normal lawyer disbarred? If members of Congress who have law degrees are doing this, why aren't, could they be disbarred for this?
It's a good question. I want to see the evidence. I don't want to just take accusations on face value. I want to lay out what was in the tape. I want to see what was edited out. As you know, I'm suing CNN for doctoring a tape of what I said in the Senate a year ago. And in my case, it was clear doctoring. They took out the words unlawful and illegal and made it sound like I said the president could do anything, even if it's unlawful or illegal. If anything like that happened, it would and should result in appropriate criticism. Whether bar associations would look at what a senator or congressman said would raise constitutional questions, because the Constitution says that members of Congress shall not be questioned anywhere else, that means a bar association, for what they said or did on the floor of Congress. So I doubt that we would see bar associations having the power to do that. But it's also very foolish for lawyers to do it because the other side points it out. And if you have a real jury, the jury says, oh, my God, we can't trust anything that they said. You know, we won the O.J. Simpson case not because we, the defense, won. It's because the prosecution lost their credibility. They put on false evidence. They put on evidence that had been tampered with by police officers. We caught them. We exposed them. And the jurors told us afterward that that's what did it for most of them, that they just couldn't trust the prosecution's case because we had caught them tampering with the evidence. And I think the same thing is true on impeachment trials and regular trials. So my word for practicing lawyers, prosecutors, defense attorneys, don't tamper with the evidence. Don't edit out things that don't help you. Lay it all out and then explain it. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own facts.
Professor Dershowitz, this is Ron from Pennsylvania. I really enjoy your shows and appreciate the clarity you bring to constitutional issues. It's great to have someone with your expertise doing these podcasts. I wanted to ask you a question about the witness discussion that occurred during the impeachment trial last week. The Senate debated about calling witnesses and eventually chose not to. And during the debate, the House managers were going to call, I think it was Representative Jamie Herrera Butler, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, to testify about a story she says was recounted to her about a conversation between Kevin McCarthy and then President Trump. Now, my question is, if she was not part of that conversation, didn't witness it, what could qualify her as a witness in an impeachment trial? And secondly, what relevance could her second or third hand statement, which was eventually read into the record, really have? Why bother? Was it just more political theater? Thank you. And again, I enjoy the show.
Great question. Of course, her testimony would have been classic hearsay. She could not testify as to what President Trump said because she didn't hear what President Trump said. She couldn't be cross-examined about whether she heard clearly what President Trump said, what the context was, because she didn't hear any of that. The only thing she is a direct witness to is that Congressman McCarthy said that the president said. In a normal trial, both a civil and criminal trial, of course it would be excluded as hearsay. It's not even a close question. This is impeachment. And so they tried to introduce this hearsay testimony. In the end, they stipulated, I wish they had stipulated that they would admit the Congresswoman's hearsay statement and make it clear that it was hearsay. But I think everybody understood it was hearsay and not particularly relevant. And it was absolutely crucial to question the person who spoke to President Trump about his tone, about exact timing, about what precipitated the statement. All of those are what would happen on cross-examination. And that's why if they were going to call anybody under the best evidence rule, they should have called the person who had the conversation with President Trump, allegedly, not the person to whom he recounted the conversation. So it was political theater, and had it been a real trial, it would have been excluded as hearsay.
Professor Dershowitz, Mark Sirabella, Clifton, New Jersey. It is my understanding that if you are arrested for, say, eating a carrot on Sunday, you should refuse to make a plea because the action does not allege a legal offense. If you make a plea, you give the court jurisdiction over you, even though the court does not have legal jurisdiction. In like manner, in this past impeachment, I contend that irrespective of how a senator voted, the very act of casting a vote conceded jurisdiction to the Senate to try ex officios. A senator should vote present, which has the same effect as no. Why, where am I wrong? Thank you for your podcast.
It's an interesting argument. If I were accused of eating a carrot on Sunday, I would enter a plea. If not guilty, I wouldn't challenge the jurisdiction of the court. Courts have jurisdiction over complaints. I'll never forget my father sold men's underwear and work clothes in New York, and he kept his store open on Sunday because he couldn't open on Saturday because Saturday was Shabbos, the Jewish rest day, and he kept getting arrested, and he always got acquitted because it turns out men's underwear is a necessity and you can sell it on Sunday. So even though he thought he was committing a violation of the Sunday Blue Laws, he wasn't. But just because there isn't a crime alleged doesn't mean the court doesn't have a jurisdiction. So if you're ever arrested for eating a carrot on Sunday, my suggestion is you go to court and you plead not guilty, raise the jurisdictional issues right away, but don't refuse to plead. The Senate, that would have been an interesting tactic for the senators who voted that there was no jurisdiction to simply vote present. Remember, the two-thirds vote under the Constitution is not two-thirds of all the senators. It's two-thirds of all the senators who are present. And so if only 90 senators showed up, all they'd need was 60. Senators are supposed to show up, obviously. But, you know, in the last impeachment, if I remember correctly, maybe one of the senators was sick. I'm not sure about that. But it's the number of senators who actually show up. And voting present, I guess, is you're there. So you need so voting present is probably the equivalent of voting no. It would have been an interesting tactic for those who deny jurisdiction. I'm in conversation on email with a very good friend of mine, a brilliant lawyer, who believes that once the Senate voted to have jurisdiction, all the senators were bound by that vote. It was the law of the case. And that meant that they couldn't vote to acquit on jurisdictional grounds. It's a very, very compelling argument. And had the House managers raised that in the form of a motion and gotten a ruling from the chair, it would have been interesting to see what senators would have done. But as commonly happened in this case, the House managers didn't do what they should have done. They obviously came up with the worst pleading, the worst forms of impeachment articles, fell into every possible trap, and they didn't make a motion binding the senators. Don't know whether the motion would have succeeded, whether the senators would have felt bound by it, but my friend who makes the argument makes a brilliant point, as do you. So these are issues that are still to be resolved. I hope we'll never see them resolved in our lifetime, because I don't want to see another impeachment in my lifetime, and I hope to live a long, long time. So let's hope that impeachment is a thing of the past. We had almost none. We had one in the first 100 and, 50 or 70 years of our existence, one impeachment of a president, and then we had basically four since that time, if you count Richard Nixon.
Hello, Professor Dershowitz. This is Matt from Chemung, New Jersey. With New York Times versus Sullivan, recent articles have been written calling it a potential metaphorical sword against misinformation and lies on the internet. This is because it states a speaker can be held liable for defamation if A, that person knew what he or she was saying was false, or if B, he or she acted with reckless indifference to the question of truth. If a speaker sincerely thinks he or she is telling the truth, that person is unprotected. It should have been obvious that the information was false. Could you expound on the aforementioned use of New York Times versus Sullivan against misinformation on the internet? Thanks.
To summarize New York Times versus Sullivan, it basically gives people the right to be wrong. The right to be wrong, as long as they're not lying, as long as they're not deliberately, willfully misstating facts defamatory to an individual. Now, is it enough that they honestly believe it? Is it enough to believe that Hillary Clinton engaged in pedophile at a pizza shop? Remember that kind of argument? It's such an absurd, ridiculous belief. I don't think the courts would accept that. They would say it has to be reasonably believed. But the New York Times versus Sullivan is clearly an invitation to the media to promote untruths, as long as they don't do it with malice. And malice is very difficult. My case against CNN is going to be an interesting test case on that issue, because it's clear that Jeff Zucker and the head of CNN made a decision from the very top to doctor my tape and eliminate the words unlawful and illegal, in order to portray me in a negative light. There's absolutely no doubt about that. We can prove it. I don't think it will be disputed. But they'll argue that they had the right to doctor the tape because I did say the actual words that they put on the air. Yeah, I said those words, but I said others right in proximity that they took out. So that'll be an interesting test on the limits of New York Times versus Sullivan, and I'm anxious to see how that comes down. I am a strong believer in free speech. I'm a believer in the right to be wrong, but I don't believe in abusing the First Amendment to deliberately and willfully defame somebody knowing that what you're putting on the air is a total and complete falsehood. That's what CNN did.
Hi, this is Dr. Jensen from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I have formally studied and have unfortunately experienced the devastating consequences of groupthink. I recently heard an author describe it in this way: groupthink is unchallenged thinking. I am deeply concerned about the vicious attack on individuals who choose to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. Not long ago, It seemed that professionals could argue in a courtroom or in a government chamber and at the end of the day have a drink and play cards with their opponent. What happened to civility? From the outside looking in, it appears to me that Washington has lost its collective mind. And here's my question. What do you think could be done to break this toxic cycle of rage? Thank you.
It's a great question. I agree with you. I have experienced groupthink all over the place. People, you know, criticize me for having defended President Trump's constitutional rights. The people who criticize me have never read anything I wrote, never heard anything I said. But people say that I supported Trump and I defended Trump. So people believe what people say. There is such a groupthink. When you watch CNN, you see the groupthink. There's no dissenting view there. They sit around, they pat each other on the back. Their audience sits there smiling and smirking because they are hearing what they want to hear. And you're absolutely right. And it is, it affects civility, because if you know you're right and the other side is completely wrong because CNN told you that, then why should you be civil toward people who are just totally and completely wrong? So the two go together. The fact that we have groupthink, that we don't tolerate dissent any longer on shows, on CNN and other media, and the fact that because we think the groupthink must be correct, we don't have to be civil to the people who have another point of view, goes hand in hand. I think it's a very, very serious problem. I fight against it on the Dirt Show. I fight against it in all aspects of my life, but we have to prevail. Otherwise, we'll be a much, much, much poorer country, intellectually, morally, politically, and legally, if we allow this trend toward the new McCarthyism to continue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dershowitz. My name is Anthony Iannetta. I live in Cleveland, Ohio, and I thank you for your show. And I would like to know what could be done when the evidence and facts of the issue refuses to be heard. What can be done further? Thank you very much. I look forward to hearing you.
Well, thanks. Good question. You know, if you ever have a situation where your views can't be heard, call in the Dirt Show. They'll all be heard here. You'll always have an opportunity to express your views here. I think people have to write letters to the editor. People have to call into talk shows. People have to make their voices heard. It's not easy. I recently wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times about a mistake, and I never even got a response from the Times. Never even got an acknowledgement, except a formal acknowledgement saying your letter has been received. And so it's very difficult today to have your voice heard, but you can always have it heard on the Dirt Show. And, you know, I know I really appreciate a lot of you calling in and saying how much you enjoy the show. Please tell your friends, because, you know, we don't have a lot of advertising other than word of mouth. And so the only way to get the message out that people will really enjoy listening to the Dirt Show is to tell them about it. Tell them to subscribe. Tell them to subscribe on Rumble if they don't want to have any censorship on YouTube, on any of the other platforms. But I want more listeners and viewers. I want more callers. I want more people to engage with me and demonstrate that the Dirt Show is a model for A, civility, and B, dialogue. I don't ever censor a call that comes in, and I hope I will be able to continue that tradition. Your calls are thoughtful, intelligent, provocative, and I hope my answers satisfy you. I don't always agree with you, but that's the nature of an interesting dialogue. So we may be finished with our discussion of the Trump era for now. Obviously, more issues will come up, but boy, there are plenty of other issues to talk about. We'll be talking a lot about censorship, about free speech. We'll be talking about so many other issues on future podcasts of The Dirt Show. So please tune in and tell your friends. An important part of the Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine.
Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.